in creative acts or in the work, the labor, the straining that it takes to make a work of art, be it a poem or a painting. You often read of poets or artists talking about the struggle and even the frustration when the final product emerges.
Rebecca Ann Lamb is lecturer in theology, imagination, and the arts at the University of St. Andrews. Her work explores intersections between theology, visual arts, and literature, and she has additional interests in biblical studies, Dante, and Christian personalism, which asserts the ultimate value of persons, human and divine.
In prayerful contemplation, one starts to see more deeply into the reality of things. Union in prayer with Christ means that even in the dark periods, and especially in the dark periods, a light can come and it announces itself as sheer gift.
We speak with her today about theological aesthetics, asking what theology and the arts bring to each other, and focus particularly on the work of the Canadian Catholic artist and novelist Michael D. O'Brien. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Rebecca Ann Lamb, joining us from St. Andrews. It's great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, listen, my pleasure. And you were recommended to us, actually, so I'm really grateful you accepted the invitation. I like to begin, as you probably aware, by asking our guests about how faith informs our life and work. Now, you've written an article about an artist, the Canadian Catholic painter and author Michael D. O'Brien, whose work and art are all about his faith. And we'll talk about that article and about O'Brien's work in our conversation. But first, what's the relationship between faith, life, and work for you?
That's a great question. It's a big one as well. And I have to say, I have thought about it a lot. First off, I think it might be helpful to share what faith is for me. It's not just an assent to a creed, to a profession of belief in a series of formulations about who God is. It is, of course, that, and that's an important part. It's really the foundation for so much that follows from that. But as importantly, it's an assent to a way of living, I think. To appeal to John Henry Newman, who is a thinker I do a lot of work on, faith, he says, is not only notional, it's also real. It's a lived, felt reality because it's a relationship with a personal and living God. So it's tied to faith. Faith for me is very much tied to daily conversion. I need daily conversion, to be honest. A daily turning back to the most important things, to encountering God in scripture, liturgy, my daily routines, personal relationships, and obviously work, since I spend a lot of my time working, as we all do. And so there's an important link, I think, between not only what you believe notionally, but also how it then translates into your daily life. So I very often see work as an opportunity to more deeply explore and think about questions of value that are shaped by my faith. I understand my faith is something which can even expand the horizons of inquiry. There's this lovely phrase that Seamus Heaney uses where he says that poetry can extend our alphabet. It's a way of saying and thinking in and of itself. And I would say faith is very much like that too. It's a way of extending my alphabet, of widening the horizons of what I can say and think about the world. And so this is why, as an academic and teacher, I'm very interested in exploring how literature, which is the study of human experience through story, through forms of narrative or narrative breakdown, how literature can really be informed by theology, which is the study of God, of God's nature and work. And I'm fascinated by the ways in which literature often plots out and explores convergences or conflicts between human lived experience and then assent to faith or say articles of faith. And so that's one of the many ways I see faith and especially my work and daily life.
I think that's great. I love that Heaney quote about expanding the alphabet. That really rings true for me. And I also, what you say about the relational nature of faith, kind of the personal nature, the personal relationship with God, those are things that are very important to me. Now, I've got to ask you, you have a PhD in English from the University of Western Ontario, but you work in the School of Divinity at the University of St. Andrews, which is such a beautiful place. I'm wondering how you got from Canada to Scotland and from an English department to a School of Divinity.
Right. That's a good question. I get asked that question a lot. Well, it was an unexpected journey, I have to say that. And it wasn't something that I was planning per se, but I still pinch myself. I'm so delighted that I'm here. I've been here now for almost 3 years. As of August 1st, I'll have been in St. Andrews for 3 years. When I was in graduate school at Western University, I first heard about a particular institute that's situated within the University of St. Andrews. It's called ITIA, or the Institute of Theology, Imagination, and the Arts. And what I found so fascinating about this institute was that it was very much open to exploring the ways in which theological questions are enlivened by interaction with the arts and vice versa. I have to say that during my experience in graduate school, if religion was given any room in my coursework period of study, it was very often associated with systems of power and repression. Now, of course, those systems are operative, and there are times when Christianity has been very problematically applied or abused and so on. But I found myself disappointed, really, that there wasn't a wider approach very often to the question of religion and its influence on the people I was writing about and thinking about, particularly Christina Rossetti, the Pre-Raphaelites, and their affiliate circles in the Victorian period. My supervisor was very open to these kinds of questions, but I often found I had to do a lot of explaining just to get across that I found faith and literature to really work in a very interesting kind of relationship, and often a very enlivening one, as opposed to just, say, a repressive one. So I was doing quite a bit of research at the time, trying to see if there were perhaps other places or even schools of criticism and so on that were emerging that were more open to different approaches to religion. And ITIA was one of those places that I found when I was doing my research. And indeed, I was continually starting to look UK words, because the emergent, I would say, field of religion and literature has really been growing and expanding in the UK context, and is really starting to inform my area of specialization, which is Victorian studies. So I was following ITIA, I was very interested in it, and I thought, you know, what a wonderful place to perhaps be associated with someday. While I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Toronto at St. Michael's College, a position opened up in ITIA, and so I applied, of course, but I didn't think that, you know, it would amount to much. The job market is so incredibly competitive right now, as I'm sure many listening know. Long story short, I ended up with the position. And so I made the move. And part of the reason why I was willing to, you know, move to a whole other country, even though my world was very much in Canada, born and raised in Toronto, I had hoped to stay there. I was just so enlivened by the kind of scholarship and the scholarly community that is in ITIA at the School of Divinity in St. Andrews. And so that's how I ended up over here.
What a dream come true. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for it.
Well, you're producing a lot of really wonderful work that really has, I think, opened up expansively into a number of areas. The article that we're going to talk about today that you published recently is titled Michael O'Brien's Theological Aesthetics. And maybe we could talk a bit about what that means, the theological aesthetics, a little bit. Actually, for listeners who might not be familiar with some of the categories that you invoke in the essay, I wonder if you could briefly define the difference between a few of them. So there's theological aesthetics, there's philosophical theology, spiritual theology, and art history. Perhaps you could walk through briefly what these categories mean in relation not only to O'Brien's art, but Christian art in general.
Sure. Okay. These are very good questions and requests, and I'll try to do my best in the time that we have. I'll start off with, these are very much working definitions. And so I think what might be helpful is, as I describe the different concepts, I'll pull a little bit from O'Brien's work.
Great.
I thought it might be helpful to draw examples from the artwork that is in the article that I published, because Michael very kindly gave me permission to use the art that's there. And not all of his art is open access. So for those who might not have access to the catalog of his art, I thought it might be helpful to pull from that. So first off, theological aesthetics, in general, it's interest in how different art forms in their own right can express aspects of the nature of God or theological inquiry, such as God's goodness or God's relation to the cosmos. This is theological aesthetics within the Christian tradition. It is also interested in looking at the ways in which the human person, who is understood to be made in the image and likeness of God, can participate in God's creative work through his or her own artistic endeavors. Now, theological aesthetics is a term that was popularized, especially in 20th century theology, particularly through the work of Hans Urs von Balthasar, but also a variety of other interlocutors across Christian denominations. It's actually become a site of some really fruitful ecumenical conversation throughout the 20th century in particular. We can think also of other figures like Dietrich Bonhoeffer or Karl Barth, who offered quite a bit when it comes to the widening conversation around theological aesthetics in the 20th century. Now, theological aesthetics, most would argue, has been ongoing since the early church. There is increasingly research done on the rich and vast material culture that surrounds the development of the early church, from funerary art to the emergence of icons, and then debates around the use of icons in, say, the 5th century onwards, and even a bit earlier. But the actual category or term theological aesthetics really got going in the 20th century, and it draws particularly from the concept of the aesthetic, which gets crystallized around the Enlightenment period onwards. And the aesthetic has a lot to do with questions of taste, how the subjective viewer may approach the question of beauty and of value. And it also is often interested in the question of how can a subjective perception of the exterior world nonetheless somehow participate in or discern the truth? So that opens up a whole series of other interesting questions that start to get into things like cognitive psychology or psychoanalysis or metaphysics and ethics and so on. So it opens up quite a few other very important related questions. But in general, it's interested in the ways in which perceptions of beauty and taste can be informed by theology and contribute to it. If we think about Michael O'Brien's own art and his theological aesthetics, we very much get a certain kind of understanding of beauty in his art. And one thing that I traced in my article, which was very much an introduction to his theological aesthetics, I traced this notion of the cruciform pattern that seems to be at the heart of his understanding of beauty. Now that might sound a little strange because really a crucifix, there's nothing beautiful about it on the purely, subjective plane of, say, looking at a crucifix. Of course, within Christian material culture, we've gotten used to depictions of the crucifix, but if you step back a little bit, it's quite a grotesque thing to focus on or to look at. For O'Brien, however, it is a unique and strange kind of beauty because it's through the cross that Christ births our redemption. It is through his death and his passion that the resurrection can then occur. And so for O'Brien, all of a sudden the concept of beauty is burst open, as it were, and is changed in a very particular way, and only by virtue of the Christian narrative of understanding of what salvation is and what suffering and beauty is and how they're linked in the person of Christ. Now, that concept is not unique to O'Brien, though it does really emerge from and crystallize through a series of conversations, theological conversations that happen not only in the early church in the patristic age, but then also in the 20th century, especially in the thought of von Balthasar and Pope John Paul II, as well as Joseph Ratzinger, who are all very important interlocutors for O'Brien. And in particular, Ratzinger has an essay called The Feeling of Things, The Contemplation of Beauty, where he talks about how the particular suffering of Christ and the redemption that is born from it offers us the ability to say, even in the midst of the evils of the 20th century, beauty still has a right to exist. And so as a result, O'Brien's concept of beauty is very much tied up with the Christian theological tradition. And as a result, when you look at his art, for instance, some of the paintings that are in this article that I published, and these images are open access, you see, for instance, even in his depiction of the nativity or the birth of Christ, Christ is not just a child. He doesn't look just like a child. He also looks like an aged man. And he's wrapped not just in swaddling clothes, but they also double as a burial shroud. So life and death, the beauty of new life and the sorrow of death are yoked together. And then in the background of the painting of the Nativity, you see a triadic cluster of three crosses. So obviously that's a foreshadowing of Christ's death. But it is also the gateway to the resurrection as well. And so that's one of the ways in which from looking at O'Brien's art, we can see a particular theological aesthetic emerge. That is a particular way of understanding beauty according to some fundamental articles of belief that are from the Christian tradition. So that's perhaps something of an introduction to theological aesthetics. I can move to philosophical theology, but you may also, you know, want to ask me something further from what I just said.
Well, I think what you said is really fascinating. It was a great kind of overview, by the way. Thank you very much about theological design. And I'll add, you know, sort of von Balthasar, who talks about this at length, wrote a multi-volume work. So what you just distilled was really well done, Rebecca, to do in just a few minutes like you did. I think that the point you made early in what you just said about the cross, that it is, in some respects, outwardly not aesthetically pleasing, but becomes beautiful given its context in the larger Christian narrative, is really provocative because it brings out that something can be at some level ugly and yet beautiful at the same time, which really does open aesthetics in all kinds of interesting ways. It opens our experience of art in some really provocative and challenging ways that O'Brien certainly exploits and explores. You made many great points. That one really jumped out to me when you said that. I thought, yeah, that's right what she said. It's true.
Thank you.
Let me ask you something about scholarship at present in theological. I want to get to O'Brien, so well, I'll just ask you this, and we'll kind of make the transition to O'Brien's work in particular. But in the scholarly field of theological aesthetics, what do you find most exciting about current scholarship in it? What would you like to find in it more than perhaps you do?
That's a really great question. We could talk about that for quite some time, I think. First, what I'll do is share a book that I found really instructive for teaching theological aesthetics. There's a course I teach at the University of St. Andrews in a master's program we have on theology and the arts. And the course I teach is called Christian Doctrine and the Arts. So we look at the articles of faith within the Apostles' Creed, and we pair it with artistic representations or critiques of these articles of faith. And a book that I found really helpful is Richard Velasco's Classical Theological Aesthetics. Not only because he has a very rich ecumenical approach to the question of the aesthetic and its place within Christianity, because we know the use of the arts in Christian faith is a live hot topic, and there's a lot of debate about it within Christian denominations, and we only need to quickly scan church history to see that it is not a straightforward thing, even though it's incredibly important. Most important things aren't straightforward, but that's a very helpful book. And I think what I'm really seeing across a variety of different fields within theology and systematic and historical theology and practical theology and so forth are different ways in which the aesthetic is being understood as enlivening liturgical worship, our understanding even of cognitive psychology. I have some colleagues here at the University of St. Andrews who are doing some very interesting work on the relationship between cognitive psychology and the arts. You're also seeing ways in which questions of the aesthetic are being drawn on to explore the problem of evil, or the study of theodicy, which is basically the question of how can we say there is a good God when there's suffering in the world. Eleanor Stump wrote a really excellent book on the problem of Job and the problem of suffering very recently, and she drew so richly, I think, from aesthetic interpretations of scripture and so forth to really help us get into the heart of that question of the problem of pain. And so you are really seeing a whole host of different scholars exploring the question and the place of the aesthetic from a variety of different fields. Something that I would like to see even more expressly is, I think, the question of the aesthetic in the role of everyday life and living. We especially find from things like city planning to our daily routines and habits, especially when right now across the world, most of us who are fortunate enough to be working are working in a very virtual world. And we're very often cut off from a lot of the elements of the beautiful in daily life, such as nature, frankly, even just physical interactions with other people and so on. And I think there is such a deep wealth of understanding of the incarnational element of the aesthetic, of the way in which beauty is not just, you know, a luxury, but I think is also actually a necessity for daily life. And there are lots of ways to be to find and discern the beautiful in daily life. So I would like to see more work done on that.
That'd be great. I read actually a book a few years ago about ambient aesthetics, you know, the aesthetics of ambiance, kind of aesthetics, beauty that's in the air, but that you almost look past it because it doesn't bring attention to itself as art, but it's drawing upon art principles in order to bring your attention to something else. And it could be just an advertising, or it could be, you know, a lot in people in fashion or self-presentation or ways that, and I think that would be, I think I'd love to see something like that, especially from a theological aesthetic standpoint. That would be fascinating. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about O'Brien now. What was it that drew you to O'Brien's work? I mean, was it his art? Was it his story? Is it the relationship between his art and his devotional life? Or what was it?
Good question. I think there's so many ways I could approach it. I have to confess, I first encountered his art when I was probably around 3 or 4 years old.
Wow.
Because sometimes my parents would host him when he was coming to Toronto to do some small scale art exhibitions.
Oh, no kidding. It's fascinating.
Yeah. In the late 80s, early 90s. Canada is not a huge country. Well, it's a massive country in terms of landmass, but population wise, you know, a lot of Catholics know each other across provinces and communities and so on. So from a very young age, I was exposed to his art because sometimes it was, you know, in our house, although I only have very limited recollection of that. But our family had the tradition of praying the rosary in the evening together. And he had published a book of meditations on the rosary, really drawing on how different decades of the rosary reflect on certain events within scripture. And then those events within scripture form the basis of a series of short meditations that are sustained across about the 15 minutes it takes to pray the rosary. His book goes through each mystery of the rosary, focusing on certain events like the Annunciation or the Nativity, as I just described, Christ's Passion, and then also, of course, the Glorious Mysteries, where there's reflection on his triumph over sin and death, his transformation of history through his resurrection and his ascension and so on. And so when we were young, because a lot of us were restless and frankly rather bored praying the rosary when we were young, my parents would encourage us to look at these images just to kind of, you know, see if they would help us with our attention. And I was very gripped by these paintings. I've always been very moved by art. I have a very, I guess, visually oriented imagination. So I always grew up in kind of the atmosphere of O'Brien's visual art. And especially moving over to Scotland, I've been thinking a lot about certain aspects of my Canadian identity, or say even the Christian artistic context in Canada. And there's quite a bit to be said about it that hasn't really been written yet, to be honest, especially when it comes to the explosion of kind of devotional art in the context of the 20th century in Canada. Canada became a refuge for a lot of people fleeing particular, well, from various political problems and travesties, but especially so for people from, say, Russia or the Ukraine, who were fleeing the growing persecution that often came with Soviet totalitarianism. And that's particularly true of Russian writers like Catherine Doherty, who some may be familiar with, who founded the Madonna House lay apostolate and really helped to introduce the devotional practice of icon writing to a lot of different interested Christian Canadians. The same with the painter, the acclaimed Canadian painter, William Kirilek, whose family had a Ukrainian background and knew what it was like to suffer through the horrors of living in the Ukraine in the early 20th century. The forced famines and so on. He was really interested in the ways in which coming to Canada, he had sort of a wider space to explore some of the spiritual problems and questions of the day. And he became a very good friend and mentor to Michael O'Brien, and really helped to inspire Michael's art and his writing. There's a reason why Eastern Europe has really picked up Michael O'Brien, and I think in a way he's kind of inherited some of the concerns and preoccupations of the people in exile in the 20th century, which might go some of the way to helping to explain the apocalyptic pitch or register of some of his own writing and his approach to things, which we could talk about at length. That aspect of Canadian devotional writing and community in the 20th century hasn't really yet been fully discussed. Clemens Kavelin has done some great initial work by writing the first biography of O'Brien's work and his life. But there's still a lot left to be said and done, really. And I think partly because a lot of this work is just going on quietly and it's picked up reception in certain pockets of Canada. And then frankly, has received quite a lot of reception in continental Europe, but it's not really been discussed in scholarship, and there are all sorts of reasons for that, but it fascinates me. It touches on some of my own personal history, so I'd like to explore it further.
Yeah, that's good. You say you found it at you kind of first became aware of it around age 3 or 4. It only took me about an additional half century. it was through your essay, which I'm grateful for. But I was, when I read your essay, I was curious about O'Brien. So I went and got one of his books, The Apocalypse, and I read through and looked through the beautiful collection of paintings published a couple of years ago, The Art of Michael D. O'Brien. And I read the Clemens Kavelin biography on the Edge of Infinity. So I'm now more aware of O'Brien than I was. Thank you very
Quite
much.
Impressed.
Well, yeah, thank you. I was impressed with your essay. That's why I went and did all this. One of the points that comes through in Kavelin's biography, and this is something I really admire about O'Brien, is the degree to which his devotional life plays into his work, really plays into his entire life. And several passages in the biography describe O'Brien setting out to paint or write, finding he's bereft of inspiration, and remaining really in this uninspired, almost abject condition for weeks on end. Yeah. But then, as Kavelin describes it, at some moment of peaked frustration, O'Brien will pray, and he'll find inspiration, he'll find an image of what he's going to paint that bursts into his mind. Is that at all a common experience in the religious artists that you study?
That's a really good question, and I think yes, it's often common, and I would say it's common even for those who would not say that they are religious. There is in creative acts or in the work, the labor, the straining that it takes to make a work of art, be it a poem or a painting, you often read of poets or artists talking about the struggle and even the frustration when the final product emerges, if I dare call it a product. That probably sounds that doesn't do a work of art justice. But you know, there are even famous accounts of Michelangelo being very frustrated with the end result of the Sistine Chapel. Always already the vision is greater than the what you're able to put in into practice. So there's that element. I often think of the Jesuit poet Gerard Manley Hopkins, who is very dear to me, where he talks about, you know, the efforts and the strains and the labor that it takes to write a poem. And he talks about, you know, at one point in one of his sonnets saying he cannot breed one work that wakes. It's just, it feels like he's always already not up to the task that he feels drawn to, and that as a creative person he longs to accomplish. So there is that element, I think, you know, and psychologists have a lot to say about even the paradoxically valuable element of frustration in the creative process. As a side note, I'm completing a book on the aesthetic and theological implications of boredom in the Victorian period and late modernity. And there is a lot of conversation around the value of boredom, even in the creative process. So there's that element. But I think also, if we look at even the history of Christian spiritual theology, which is a more, spiritual theology is a more contemporary term for, say, mystical theology or the ascetic tradition, you'll often see that the Christian, in seeking to imitate Christ's life, will often start to experience or at least be able to see aspects of his or her life, you know, really drawn into close affinity with Christ's own. There are a lot of periods where, for instance, he's in the desert and he's tempted and he suffers greatly, or there is the profound loneliness and almost and the great almost disappointment in the Garden of Gethsemane when his friends completely leave him. You know, these existential experiences are common across, I think, the human condition, but they're brought to a particular pitch in the Christian narrative, particularly because Christ redeems and transforms these abject experiences. And so I think at one level, it makes complete sense that if union in prayer with Christ means that even in the dark periods, and especially in the dark periods, a light can come and it announces itself as sheer gift. And I think that's very important in O'Brien's own understanding of the artistic process. In some of his interviews, even in his own paintings and writings, you can see him understanding the creative act as partly his own efforts and also that which comes from outside of him. And that really is, one could say, perhaps an extended metaphor for the very act or for the very reality of existence itself. Something he talks about a lot is, you know, we didn't ask to be created, it's sheer gift. And so you receive the good, the bad, the ugly, all as part of the process. And so for him, in his creative work, when in these dark periods, inspiration comes, he would see very much, he would see that as a gift of the Holy Spirit. And in one of the paintings that is included in the article I wrote, it's called The Artist Studio. And in it, you see the various tools of the artist's workshop. So you have acrylic paint and an easel and so on. But you also have the inclusion of the Holy Spirit in the painting. And you also have a kind of subtle light source emerging from the icon that is in progress that the artist is painting in this image. And the point here that O'Brien wants to make, amongst other things, he wants to drive home the point that the creative process is always already a mysterious combination of our own efforts and then the work of grace.
Great, yeah. And in that painting, right across the top is that dove, right? The
yes.
Symbol of the Holy Spirit, which imbues the work with the inspiration that it needs. In fact, one of the things that Cavelin writes in his introduction to the big book of O'Brien's paintings, he says this, which I think really brings home what you just said. He said, "It's in deep prayer and in a simple life in accordance with one's spirit, taking up our cross, as it were, that we find ourselves." Cavelin writes, quote, in a sense, this makes failure the solution, not in a tragic way, the death of a hero against overwhelming odds, but as a recognition of the inadequacy of human power and the necessity of divine intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, in your article, you write that one of its aims is to expound on the roles which prayer and contemplation play in the exercise of the imagination. Mm-hmm. What roles are these?
That's a great question. Well, I think especially if we just turn to O'Brien's art as, you know, well, his different paintings are all, I think, case studies for different aspects of the spiritual life, really. He explores such a wide gamut of different experiences in life, from profound joy and intimacy in, say, the family home, to existential despair and loneliness and great suffering. And what seems very clear in his art, and also particularly in his writing on his understanding of the artistic process, is that if art is pursued for the sake of one's own desires only, the artist will be particularly frustrated and disappointed in a particular way. He talks quite a bit about the power of the aesthetic and of beauty to kind of become its own idol, as it were. There are a lot of very interesting parallels between his thought on the link between art and the idol that you could put in conversation with, say, Jean-Luc Marion's work on this similar subject, on the idol, as well as Rowan Williams's, and the list goes on. But for O'Brien, one of the safeguards against turning art into a god, as it were, is to be humble. And humility means to understand who you are in relation to the world and God. And in prayerful contemplation, one starts to see more deeply into the reality of things. And so O'Brien would hold that prayer gives the artist the kind of insight needed to paint not just with, let's say, the eye, but with the eye of the soul, and to really see more deeply into the life of things. And I think there are a lot of ways in which O'Brien's understanding of the arts is, whether he would view it or not, like this, a rather striking fusion of certain understandings of the insight of the artist that is especially developed in, say, the writing of Samuel Taylor Coleridge and so forth, and then yoked together with the development of theological aesthetics in the 20th century in the writing of von Balthasar, especially John Paul II and so on, where, especially in JP2's writing, the short form for John Paul II, especially in a letter he wrote to artists, he said that artists have a very special ability to see deeply into the meaning of life, to look at things and ponder them. And he invites artists to pray when they're pondering the things of life, because then the looking is not monological, rather it becomes dialogical, because prayer is a conversation with God. So for O'Brien, prayer is inviting God into the creative process.
Great. I suppose on that subject, I guess I'd ask you maybe as a follow-up question, this thing here. I've got various parts of your article I really want to talk to you about. We don't have a whole lot of time. Sure. I'll ask you this.
Okay.
He says something in the preface to his volume of paintings that you cite in your article, and I wonder whether you'd elaborate on that point for us. I'm quoting here from your article, and you're quoting O'Brien. You write, O'Brien proposes that the artist's primary calling is neither popularity nor success. Rather, it is the call to love, to become a saint. For most of us, O'Brien writes, the path is one of long, hard labors combined with the spirit of exploration and, above all, a spirit of love, which is the means and motive of the growth. At the core of all genuine love is the willingness to sacrifice, to die to oneself so that others may live. Can you expand on that point? I mean, it really does make the path of the artist really the path of the Christian, that kind of merges the two together.
Yes. Yeah, he would see, he very much thinks of his artwork in vocational terms. And early on in his life, when he had what he called a kind of Pauline conversion moment, where the force and beauty and truth of Christianity just made itself apparent to him in a way where he felt he had no option but to embrace it and assent to it. He said it was only then that he started to recognize his talent as an artist and started to do sketches when he would go for longer walks in, say, nature, because he wanted to try to cultivate a more contemplative approach to life and to the way that he was looking at things. And so for him, for O'Brien, it's his prayer life that has always fed his creative life, and indeed been, to use his own phrases, the motive and the growth for his artistic life. And he was having quite a bit of success as an artist who was painting, you know, various subjects and themes shortly after his conversion. But then he decided to make the choice to devote himself more exclusively to creating Christian art, because he thought that there was a dearth in especially the Canadian context, for example. And in choosing that, he really had to give up a lot, especially because, you know, there wasn't really a patronage system or much interest in the Canadian Academy at the time at expressly devotional paintings. And so for him, there was quite a bit of sacrifice involved, and he had to fly in the face of even what people would call, you know, prudence sometimes, or you know, because it was quite a risk. And he also, you know, he had a family, and I think, you know, that comes through in the biography by Kavelin, that this was a very difficult choice for Ryan, and it was a gamble and kind of a leap of faith. But for him, because art was to be a way of further contemplating his relationship with Christ and the messages of Christianity, he only understands it as possible to stick to if it's fed by a life of prayer and of love, and that the motivation for creating the art can't just be for personal purposes. It has to be for something larger than oneself. So that's I think, to take a biographical look at it, that would be a further context for that quotation. But he's also pulling from a very rich Christian tradition, which you can see even in the early church, but especially as icon writing becomes more of a practice within elements of Christianity in the East and West, and then in the burgeoning of art forms in the Middle Ages, where the devotional life was the motive for the growth of the artistic life. If you think of the development of, say, the Gothic cathedral or right. illuminated manuscripts and so on.
Right. I'm curious. So you mentioned the biographical element there for O'Brien. How about for you, the autobiographical element? Is there a way that you see your own work as a scholar as related to your devotional life, or are they really two separate things?
That's a good question. I would hope they're integrated. I think the struggle of any Christian is integration. I think unity of life is a difficult thing to achieve. I do find that in praying about the work that I do, or the kinds of topics that I explore, I do often find that a greater depth or a widening of my questions emerges. I also think it helps me to take the long view. It's really hard. Academia can be a little bit of a rat race sometimes. You're always preparing for the next ref cycle, or how to explain how your research has impact in all of these quantifiable ways. You can't really rank living the good life very easily on a ref
scale. Alas, no, you can't.
Yeah. So, what I find that's helpful in endeavoring to integrate my academic work with my spiritual life is also thinking, like, you know, I only live once. What do I want to write about, and what do I want to explore? And what are some of the meaningful questions I'd like to sit with for a while? I also find that in academic work, you can't get very far if there's a lot of disturbance, right? Because you do need quite a bit of peace and consistency in your life to write well. I'd say I fail more than I succeed, that's for sure. But I do think it's very important to try to seek a unity between those things.
Yeah, well, bravo you for pursuing, you know, your what you most value in the work that you do. I think that's wonderful. By the way, for listeners who weren't familiar, the REF cycle, but REF, R-E-F, is it Research Excellence Framework? Is that what that is?
Yeah.
It's a cycle that I review every 7 years in Britain and British universities that holds so many careers and lives and departments hostage. They live in mortal terror the next cycle. I know this, I mean, worked over there myself for a while. But there is a lot of wonderful work that comes out in Britain as a result of the way people have their feet held to the fire.
But sometimes you do need a catalyst. That's very true.
Yeah, yeah. And it certainly is that. That's putting it mildly. Maybe we could conclude here with a point that you underscore in your article. It's a point about prayer. And you write this: too often, scholars of theology and related disciplines do not give the interplay between prayer and art practice the focus it deserves. My question is this: if scholars did give the relationship between prayer and art greater attention, how would that change our understanding of art? And perhaps how might it change our understanding of scholarship?
Very good question. I think a few things to say initially. Again, we could talk about this a lot more. Is I think very often in historical art criticism, or art criticism in general, as just one example, you very often see religion treated as a socioeconomic structure. And that's certainly an important element of it. And I think we ignore it at our peril. There are always various, say, systems of power that are operative in the production of art and so on. However, we often miss some of the main motivations, I think, for why people do produce, especially when you even just glance over some of the remarkable pieces of art or paintings that have been produced out of places of great suffering in, say, even the 20th century. Pope John Paul II calls the 20th century the difficult century. We've just, you know, the scale of power politics that, say, have been operative even in this century alone. Very often, even writers like Solzhenitsyn or Dostoevsky and so forth in the academy, their religious influences are sometimes just viewed from, I would say, something of a reductive or historicist approach only. And I think also what they're trying to do is seek out the meaning for life. You know, there's a metaphysical struggle going on, and they very much also understood God as personal, as relational. And so I think this does not mean scholars have to agree with Christianity, but I think a certain kind of exercise of deeper sympathetic engagement would sometimes allow us to enter into some of the really pressing problems of our recent past an even greater depth. I'm speaking generalities here, but I just do notice this sometimes. And there are a lot of factors for why, you know, religion is sometimes not given, I think, its full due. I don't really think biblical literacy is something we can take for granted anymore. There's reasons for that as well. So that's one thing I would say. And also, I think a really good example of someone, because you asked me, you know, what would scholarship that treats that look like, that treats religion with a depth look like. I think Rowan Williams does a really great job in his book on Dostoevsky, where he really explores the devotional imagination of Dostoevsky. And that's not to say it's neatly packaged. Dostoevsky is famous for saying he writes his Hosanna out of a furnace of doubt. So I think, you know, Williams takes a very nuanced and in-depth understanding of faith, and he brings that to bear on his understanding of Dostoevsky, because indeed, you know, faith was a tangle between assent and doubt for him, but it gave also a certain drive and a force to his writings that couldn't be supplied in any other way.
That's great. I have no idea how you'd really do justice to Dostoevsky without taking into account his spiritual life, you know, broadly defined, sort of the theological context for what he was doing. I'm so grateful that you have gone into the theological context for Michael O'Brien's work. It introduced me both to O'Brien and gave me a richer understanding of theological aesthetics. And I think your work is terrific, Rebecca. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you. It was such a privilege to have this chat, and thank you again.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Abby Thatcher. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.